Chapter 45. And there was some pressure too, besides the persuasiveness. Mr. Razumov was always being made to feel that he had committed himself. There was no getting away from that feeling, from that soft, unanswerable, whereto, of Counselor Mikulin. But no susceptibilities were ever hurt. It was to be a dangerous mission to Geneva for obtaining, at a critical moment, absolutely reliable information from a very inaccessible quarter of the inner revolutionary circle. There were indications that a very serious plot was being matured. The repose indispensable to a great country was at stake. A great scheme of orderly reforms would be endangered. The highest personages in the land were patriotically uneasy, and so on. In short, Councillor Mikulin knew what to say. This skill is to be inferred clearly from the mental and psychological self-confession, self-analysis of Mr. Razumov's written journal, the pitiful resource of a young man who had near him no trusted intimacy, no natural affection to turn to. How all this preliminary work was concealed from observation need not be recorded. The expedient of the oculist gives a sufficient instance. Councillor Mikulin was resourceful, and the task not very difficult. Any fellow student, even the red-nosed one, was perfectly welcome to see Mr. Razumov entering a private house to consult an oculist. Ultimate success depended solely on the revolutionary self-delusion which credited Razumov with a mysterious complicity in the Alden affair. To be calm promised in it was credit enough, and it was their own doing. It was precisely that which stamped Mr. Razumov as a providential man, white as poles apart from the usual type of agent for European supervision. And it was that which the Secretariat set itself the task to foster by a course of calculated and false indiscretions. It came at last to this, that one evening Mr. Razumov was unexpectedly called upon by one of the thinking students whom formerly, before the Alden affair, he used to meet at various private gatherings, a big fellow with a quiet unassuming manner and a pleasant voice. Recognizing his voice raised in the anteroom, "May one come in?" Razumov, lounging idly on his couch, jumped up. "Suppose he were coming to stab me?" he thought sardonically, and, assuming a green shade over his left eye, said in a severe tone, "Come in." The other was embarrassed, hoped he was not intruding. "You haven't been seen for several days, and I've wondered." He coughed a little. "He better?" "Nearly well now." "Good. I won't stop a minute. But you see I have undertaken the duty to warn you, Kirillo Sidorovich, that you are living in false security maybe." Razumov sat still with his head leaning on his hand, which nearly concealed the unshaded eye. "I have that idea too." "That's all right then. Everything seems quiet now, but those people are preparing some move of general repression." "That's of course. But it isn't that I came to tell you." He hitched his chair closer, dropped his voice. "Who will be arrested before long, we fear?" An obscure scribe in the Secretariat had overheard a few words of a certain conversation, and had caught a glimpse of a certain report. This intelligence was not to be neglected. Razumov laughed a little, and his visitor became very anxious. "Ah, Kirillo Sidorovich, this is no laughing matter. They have left you alone for a while, but... ... You had better try to leave the country, Kirillo Sidorovich, while there's yet time." Razumov jumped up, and began to thank him for the advice with mocking effusiveness, so that the other, coloring up, took himself off with the notion that this mysterious Razumov was not a person to be warned or advised by inferior mortals. Councillor Mikulin, informed the next day of the incident, expressed his satisfaction. Ha! Exactly what was wanted to. And glanced down his beard. "I conclude," said Razumov, "that the moment has come for me to start on my mission." "The psychological moment," Councillor Mikulin insisted softly, very gravely as if awed. All the arrangements to give verisimilitude to the appearance of a difficult escape were made. Counselor Mikulin did not expect to see Mr. Razumov again before his departure. These meetings were a risk, and there was nothing more to settle. We have said everything to each other by now, Kirillo Sidorovich, said the high official feelingly, pressing Razumov's hand with that unreserved heartiness a Russian can convey in his manner. Here is nothing obscure between us. And I will tell you what. I consider myself fortunate in having H'Emir. He glanced down his beard, and, after a moment of thoughtful silence, handed to Razumov a half sheet of notepaper and abbreviated note of matters already discussed, certain points of inquiry, the line of conduct agreed on, a few hints as to personalities, and so on. It was the only compromising document in the case, but, as Counselor Mikulin observed, it could be easily destroyed. Mr. Razumov had better not see anyone now till on the other side of the frontier, when, of course, it will be just that. See and hear and... he glanced down his beard. But when Razumov declared his intention to see one person at least before leaving St. Petersburg, Counselor Mikulin failed to conceal a sudden uneasiness. The young man's studious, solitary, and austere existence was well known to him. It was the greatest guarantee of fitness. He became deprecatory. Had his dear Kirillo Sidorovich considered whether, in view of such a momentous enterprise, it wasn't really advisable to sacrifice every sentiment? Razumov interrupted the remonstrance scornfully. It was not a young woman, it was a young fool he wished to see for a certain purpose. Counselor Mikulin was relieved, but surprised. Ah! And what for precisely? For the sake of improving the aspect of verisimilitude, said Razumov curtly, in a desire to affirm his independence. Must be trusted in what I do. Counselor Mikulin gave way tactfully, murmuring, Oh, certainly, certainly. Your judgment. And with another handshake they parted. The fool of whom Mr. Razumov had thought was the rich and festive student known as Madcap Kostya. Feather-headed, loquacious, excitable, one could make certain of his utter and complete indiscretion. But that riotous youth, when reminded by Razumov of his offers of service some time ago, passed from his usual elation into boundless dismay. Oh, Kirillo Sidorovich, my dearest friend, my savior, what shall I do? I've blown last night every rouble I had from my dad the other day. Can't you give me till Thursday? I shall rush around to all the usurers I know. No, of course, you can't. Don't look at me like that. What shall I do? No use asking the old man. I tell you he's given me a fistful of big notes 3 days ago. Miserable wretch that I am. He wrung his hands in despair. Impossible to confide in the old man. He had given him a decoration, a cross on the neck only last year, and he had been cursing the modern tendencies ever since. Just then he would see all the intellectuals in Russia hanged in a row, rather than part with a single rouble. Kirillo Sidorovich, wait a moment. Don't despise me. I have it. I'll do it. I'll break into his desk. There's no help for it. I know the drawer where he keeps his plunder, and I can buy a chisel on my way home. He will be terribly upset, but, you know, the dear old duffer really loves me. He'll have to get over it and I too. Kirillo, my dear soul, if you can only wait for a few hours till this evening I shall steal all the blessed lot I can lay my hands on. You doubt me? Why? You've only to say the word. Steal, by all means, said Razumov, fixing him stonily. To the devil with the Ten Commandments, cried the other, with the greatest animation. Tease the new future now. But when he entered Razumov's room late in the evening it was with an unaccustomed soberness of manner, almost solemnly. It's done, he said. Razumov sitting bowed, his clasped hands hanging between his knees, shuddered at the familiar sound of these words. Kostya deposited slowly in the circle of lamplight a small brown paper parcel tied with a piece of string. As I've said, all I could lay my hands on. The old boy'll think the end of the world has come. Razumov nodded from the couch, and contemplated the harebrained fellow's gravity with a feeling of malicious pleasure. I've made my little sacrifice, sighed Mad Kostya. And I've to thank you, Kirillo Sidorovich, for the opportunity. It has cost you something? Yes, it has. You see, the dear old duffer really loves me. He'll be hurt. And you believe all they tell you of the new future, and the sacred will of the people? Implicitly. I would give my life. Dot dot only, you see, I am like a pig at a trough. I am no good. It's my nature. Razumov, lost in thought, had forgotten his existence till the youth's voice, entreating him to fly without loss of time, roused him unpleasantly. All right. Well, goodbye. I am not going to leave you till I've seen you out of St. Petersburg, declared Kostya unexpectedly, with calm determination. Who can refuse me that now? For God's sake, Kirillo, my soul, the police may be here any moment, and when they get you, they'll immure you somewhere for ages till your hair turns gray. I have down there the best trotter of that stables and a light sledge. We shall do 30 miles before the moon sets, and find some roadside station. Dot dot, Razumov looked up amazed. The journey was decided unavoidable. He had fixed the next day for his departure on the mission. And now he discovered suddenly that he had not believed in it. He had gone about listening, speaking, thinking, planning his simulated flight, with the growing conviction that all this was preposterous. As if anybody ever did such things. It was like a game of make-believe. And now he was amazed. Here was somebody who believed in it with desperate earnestness. If I don't go now, at once, thought Razumov, with a start of fear, I shall never go. He rose without a word, and the anxious Kostya thrust his cap on him, helped him into his cloak, or else he would have left the room bareheaded as he stood. He was walking out silently, when a sharp cry arrested him. Kirillo! What? He turned reluctantly in the doorway. Upright, with a stiffly extended arm, Kostya, his face set and white, was pointing an eloquent forefinger at the brown little packet lying forgotten in the circle of bright light on the table. Razumov hesitated, came back for it under the severe eyes of his companion, at whom he tried to smile. But the boyish, mad youth was frowning. "'Tis a dream," thought Razumov, putting the little parcel into his pocket and descending the stairs. "Nobody does such things." The other held him under the arm, whispering of dangers ahead, and of what he meant to do in certain contingencies. "Preposterous," murmured Razumov, as he was being tucked up in the sledge. He gave himself up to watching the development of the dream with extreme attention. It continued on foreseen lines, inexorably logical the long drive, the wait at the small station sitting by a stove. They did not exchange half a dozen words altogether. Kostya, gloomy himself, did not care to break the silence. At parting they embraced twice it had to be done, and then Kostya vanished out of the dream. When dawn broke, Razumov, very still in a hot, stuffy railway car full of bedding, and of sleeping people in all its dimly lighted length, rose quietly, lowered the glass a few inches, and flung out on the great plain of snow a small brown paper parcel. Then he sat down again muffled up and motionless. Or the people, he thought, staring out of the window. The great white desert of frozen, hard earth glided past his eyes without a sign of human habitation. That had been a waking act, and then the dream had him again. Prussia, Saxony, Württemberg, faces, sights, words all a dream, observed with an angry, compelled attention. Zurich, Geneva still a dream, minutely followed, wearing one into harsh laughter, to fury, to death with the fear of awakening at the end. Two, perhaps life is just that, reflected Razumov, pacing to and fro under the trees of the little island, all alone with the bronze statue of Rousseau. dream and a fear. The dusk deepened. The pages written over and torn out of his notebook were the first fruit of his vision. No dream that. They contained the assurance that he was on the eve of real discoveries. Think there is no longer anything in the way of my being completely accepted. He had resumed his impressions in those pages, some of the conversations. He even went so far as to write, colon, by the by, I have discovered the personality of that terrible N.N. A horrible, paunchy brute. If I hear anything of his future movements, I shall send a warning. The futility of all this overcame him like a curse. Even then he could not believe in the reality of his mission. He looked round despairingly, as if for some way to redeem his existence from that unconquerable feeling. He crushed angrily in his hand the pages of the notebook. His must be posted, he thought. He gained the bridge and returned to the North Shore, where he remembered having seen in one of the narrower streets a little obscure shop stocked with cheap wood carvings, its walls lined with extremely dirty cardboard-bound volumes of a small circulating library. They sold stationery there too. A morose, shabby old man dozed behind the counter. A thin woman in black, with a sickly face, produced the envelope he had asked for without even looking at him. Razumov thought that these people were safe to deal with, because they no longer cared for anything in the world. He addressed the envelope on the counter with the German name of a certain person living in Vienna. But Razumov knew that this, his first communication for Counselor Mikulin, would find its way to the embassy there, be copied in cipher by somebody trustworthy, and sent on to its destination, all safe, along with the diplomatic correspondence. That was the arrangement contrived to cover up the track of the information from all unfaithful eyes, from all indiscretions, from all mishaps and treacheries. It was to make him safe, absolutely safe. He wandered out of the wretched shop and made for the post office. It was then that I saw him for the second time that day. He was crossing the Rue Mont Blanc with every appearance of an aimless stroller. He did not recognize me, but I made him out at some distance. He was very good looking, I thought, this remarkable friend of Miss Alden's brother. I watched him go up to the letterbox, and then retrace his steps. Again he passed me very close, but I am certain he did not see me that time either. He carried his head well up, but he had the expression of a somnambulist struggling with the very dream which drives him forth, to wander in dangerous places. My thoughts reverted to Natalia Alden, to her mother. He was all that was left to them of their son and brother. The Westerner in me was discomposed. There was something shocking in the expression of that face. Had I been myself a conspirator, a Russian political refugee, I could have perhaps been able to draw some practical conclusion from this chance glimpse. As it was, it only discomposed me strongly, even to the extent of awakening an indefinite apprehension in regard to Natalia Alden. All this is rather inexplicable, but such was the origin of the purpose I formed there, and then to call on these ladies in the evening, after my solitary dinner. It was true that I had met Miss Alden only a few hours before, but Mrs. Alden herself I had not seen for some considerable time. The truth is, I had shirked calling of late. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.